For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould. The work of Congress has largely ground to a halt. It seems unable to address the problems and opportunities we face in a meaningful way. The same gridlock seems to be invading our state legislature more and more. Lee Middleditch and Terry Cooper are a part of a group that's trying to do something about that. One Virginia 2021, Virginians for Fair Redistricting, is a nonpartisan group that believes that a major cause of our legislative gridlock is partisan gerrymandering, the drawing of legislative district lines for the purpose of partisan advantage. Middleditch and Cooper spoke at the Wednesday, June 11, 2014 meeting of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. The meeting was held at the Senior Center in Charlottesville. Following the presentation, questions were taken from the audience. The program was moderated by SSV President Bob McGrath. Our podcast is entitled, Can Virginians Pass a Constitutional Amendment Ending Partisan Gerrymandering? Here's Bob McGrath.
I'm Bob McGrath. I'm president of the Senior Statesmen of Virginia. This organization was founded almost 20 years ago. 2015 will be 20 years. As many of you know, its mission is to put on programs that are always very interesting and very important about public policy or political issues of interest to the local region, to the Commonwealth, and to the country. And we encourage everyone to come to all of our meetings, as you know, but if it should happen that any of you are not yet members of Senior Statesmen, if you look for any of we board members who are wearing these blue badges, it's very easy to become a member. The dues are incredibly reasonable, and you can help us in our activities. So I encourage you to do that. I want to thank Margaret and the Senior Center for allowing us to use these facilities. Senior Statesmen of Virginia is a separate organization, not affiliated with the Senior Center, but we're very grateful to them for providing this meeting space to us. Now, today our topic is redistricting. We all know about gerrymandering, redistricting, and so forth. And we have two of the leaders of a movement, which is called One Virginia 2021, Virginians for Fair Redistricting, to tell us about getting Virginia to take redistricting out of politicians' hands. Now, our first speaker is Lee Middleditch. He is a vice president in the State Government Relations Group with McGuire Woods Consulting, where his practice is now focused on non-governmental and exempt organizations. He has BA and law degrees from the University of Virginia, with which he's had many, many important connections over the years. He served on the Board of Visitors, has been the legal advisor to the university, was a founder of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, and he's been a lecturer in both the law and Darden schools. He's also been chair of the university's Health Services Foundation. Outside the university, he served as chair of the Charlottesville Albemarle and the Virginia Chambers of Commerce, as chair of divisions within the American Bar Association, and as a member of that body's Board of Governors. He's been a trustee of the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, and he's currently on the board of directors of the Montpelier Foundation. He's also on the board of directors of the University of Virginia White Burkett Miller Council and Foundation for the Study of the Presidency, and a trustee of the Claude Moore Charitable Foundation. Lee, I apologize. I've surely omitted some other important boards that you've been on. It's not clear how Charlottesville, the university, or Albemarle would operate without you. Thank you for being here. His partner, Terry Cooper, does political research, principally opposition research for Republican candidates. He's a graduate of Princeton and the University of Virginia Law School, where as a student he received several very high honors. He practiced law on Wall Street and held executive positions with three Fortune 500 companies before founding his own firm called Terry Cooper Political Research back in 1982. He's taught opposition research at the Republican National Committee's management colleges at American University, George Washington University, and the University of Florida. He's also done this at Republican training programs in a number of states, including our own state, Virginia. 2 years ago, we're happy that he talked to this group, to senior statesmen of Virginia, about why it is that many good people don't run for political office. It was a great talk, and needless to say, he knows lots of inside baseball, so to speak, about politics, and we were very happy to have him talk to about that, and I'm sure that'll come into today. So anyway, well, I should also say that we're very pleased to have Terry on our Senior Statesman of Virginia Board of Directors. So, gentlemen, would you please begin?
I think I'm going to stand up so I can see you and you all can see me. I'm Lee Middleditch, and I'm about to be 84 years of age. And I set that into context because when I was asked to be involved in redistricting by Jim Ucrop of the Ucrop department store, grocery store in Richmond, I told him that I didn't know whether I could live to take to 2021, but I would give it a shot. And it's been a wonderful opportunity. As a little bit of further background, I've been a longtime member of the League of Women Voters in Charlottesville, and some of you remember Bill Harbaugh. And we embarked, because it was a national effort at the time, 2 or 3 years ago, to address issues of redistricting and gerrymandering. Then it faded into the distance, and I sort of lost interest in it until Jim Ucrop approached me. We have a wonderful organization. We've got over 600 members across the state. I'll tell you a little bit about how we're going to approach redistricting after Terry's remarks. It's self-evident that gridlock is occurring in the United States. You can't address Social Security, which all of you are interested in, or Medicare or Medicaid, which are entitlements that are going to cost the United States more each year because of gridlock. Similarly, the attempt in the federal government to address the national debt has become gridlocked also. In part, we believe, because of the way the political system is constructed in the United States, namely that every 10 years when you have a decennial census, the party in power in your state gets to draw the lines of the districts, both for the state elections and for Congress. And the natural tendency is to draw the lines, if you're in power, 2020, to protect incumbents. And with a few exceptions, like the election yesterday, this has proved to be very effective to keep incumbents in office and to keep challengers, particularly in primaries, not to contest the election. The history in Virginia is that from time to time there have been efforts by the legislature to change the power structure that I just mentioned and to go to an independent commission to draw the lines, not the party in power. Some of you may remember that, as an example, Creed Eads, when he ran initially, that was one of the planks in his platform and the reason that I became interested in him. And I should say, as an aside, and this may be somewhat self-serving, I hold myself out to be an independent, unlike Terry, who's got his credentials pretty well established. But Cree, who has introduced a bill in the General Assembly for a number of years to change the way that the lines are drawn, has been unsuccessful. That effort in general has been conducted by the sponsors in a lobbying effort to lobby the General Assembly, particularly those who are on the House of Delegates Privileges and Elections Committee. More on that in a moment. Unsuccessfully. And what we're going to do is to take a different approach. We believe that to have some permanence, if we can pull it off, we're going to have a constitutional amendment. And most of you know that to have a constitutional amendment in Virginia, which is very difficult, you have to have an identical bill passed in two general assemblies with an election in between the two. It's going to be an uphill battle because to have a legislative, what starts out to be a legislative effort for a constitutional amendment, you have to get through, obviously, both houses of the General Assembly. Traditionally, until very recently, the Senate has been controlled by Democrats and the House by Republicans. The bills, such as Cree's bill, gets through or has gotten through the Senate, it then goes over to the House, where the Speaker, Bill Howell of Fredericksburg, assigns the bill to the Privileges and Elections Committee, which is the committee that has to pass on these bills. And traditionally, including Cree's bills, they've died in the P&E committee without any vote. And so we've decided we're going to try something else. And we're going to start off with a grassroots effort rather than the traditional lobbying effort. We think that by the end of this year, we'll have 1,000 people across the state as our supporters. And I hope that you all would pick up our bumper sticker when you leave and look at our website, One Virginia 2021, and agree to be a supporter. It doesn't cost you anything initially. We're probably going to be after you for some financial support ultimately. We think that to have an effective grassroots effort, we're going to have to raise substantial funds, and our target this year is $500,000. And to date, we've raised about 42% of that goal, and we think that by the end of the year, we'll be able to reach the full $500,000. Our guess is, and this is merely a guess, that it may take $3 million to run an effective campaign that I have outlined. So I'd like to ask you all to assist us, go to the website, become a supporter, follow us as we go around the state, and ultimately contribute. Terry?
Thank you. I want to talk about two things. Why redistricting reform and how? A common complaint I hear is that our politics, especially at the national or federal level, is too polarized. There is a pervasive feeling that our elected officials are less concerned with solving our problems and seizing our opportunities than they are with scoring political points at the expense of the other party. As a result, elected officials tend not to be held in very high repute. This is a quote from an article recently in the Washington Post. For 3 years, Congress's approval rating has never risen above 25%. In August 2012, it sank to just 10%, a record low for any Congress. Now, with those numbers, what would you expect? Wouldn't you expect a massive throw-the-bums-out movement? But what did you get in November of 2012? Only a handful of lawmakers of the 535 in Congress were tossed out. And one culprit that has been fingered for this dissonance is gerrymandering. This is a picture, or cartoon, of the original gerrymander, how congressional district lines northeast of Boston were drawn in 1812 when Elbridge Gerry, hence the name gerrymander, was governor of Massachusetts. Now, the theory that makes gerrymandering a culprit is that legislators have deliberately drawn the lines to make the districts either safe Republican or safe Democratic. In such cases, the only vulnerability those legislators face is a primary challenge from the extreme wing of their party. And in those circumstances, compromise and bipartisan are evil words. Here is how former Republican Congressman and Senator Judd Gregg of New Hampshire put it. And he was a highly respected fellow. He was the chairman of the Senate Budget Committee, the chairman of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee, and he's a very savvy observer. He addressed the question in a recent op-ed, why is Washington locked down? And he said, first is the nature of the House of Representatives. These days, somewhere between 60% and 65% of the districts are gerrymandered based on party affiliation. This means the members from those districts are assured of election once they win their party primary. Therefore, members of Congress must represent their party's base because those are the folks who vote in primaries. And once they arrive in Washington, there are certain things these representatives cannot do if they want to get reelected. Compromise, cross the aisle, reach an agreement. The base on both sides, he said, does not tolerate reasonable action, only purity. The House is thus locked down, no governing there. Now, there's another theory that I just want to call to your attention briefly, and this is the big sort theory. It says that our political polarization is a result of the confluence of three factors. One is that we as individuals have become much less tolerant of differing views. We have self-gerrymandered, physically and organizationally, socially, into distinct communities, not only geographically, but churches, clubs, social organizations. And our homogeneity, the fact that we're in a bubble and hear only opinions like our own, tends to make us even more extreme. Now, notice that the theory that gerrymandering is the culprit places the blame on the state legislators who draw the lines. The big sort theory places the blame, guess where? On us. And it's drawn from this wonderful book, which you can get on Amazon. Now, I fully subscribe to the big sort theory, but I also believe that gerrymandering is a huge cause of the problem for the reasons that Judd Gregg expounded. Today, we're going to talk about just how politically polarized are we. We're going to talk about gerrymandering, its definition, its constitutionality, and how it is handled today. And then we're going to look at the measures that four states have enacted to forbid gerrymandering and that have been seminal in our thinking as to the type of constitutional amendment we want. And then we're going to talk much more specifically about our movement. Okay, part one, how politically polarized are we? Very. And it's not just the politicians, it's us. As the famous political philosopher Pogo said, we have seen the enemy and it is us. Bill Bishop in his book said, we find people not like us, quote, to be culturally incomprehensible. We have a, quote, growing intolerance for political differences. Quote, elections are no longer just contests over policies, but bitter choices between ways of life. Steve Bell, a longtime U.S. Senate staffer, who's now with the Bipartisan Policy Committee, put it this way. He said that the two parties no longer consider each other to be just political opponents, each aiming for the same goal but having differing paths to get there. Now they consider each other to be political enemies, and indeed everything enemies of everything the other side believes in. That's pretty harsh. As an example of less tolerance of differing views, Haynes Johnson, former Washington Post reporter, wrote a wonderful book called Divided We Fall back in 1994. And in it, he interviewed a small-town Iowa pastor who said, back then, 22 years ago, everybody's got their own view of everything. Very few people are willing to sit down and talk together, reason together, try to work together. It's either my way or I'll shoot you. Now, here's some behavior by citizens, very extreme, but how different from us, I don't know. In 2004, a man swerved his car toward a congresswoman who was campaigning on a street corner. Also in 2004, an 18-year-old guy, unable to convince his girlfriend that she should vote for Bush, quote, became enraged, put a screwdriver to her throat, and threatened to kill her. Just last month, two people were arrested for threatening to kill John Boehner, the Speaker of the House. In mid-2008, Democratic pollster Peter Hart found that more than a third of each presidential candidate's supporters said they had grown to, quote, detest, close quote, the opposing candidate. Those are some indications of what the situation is, and that is extreme political polarization. And you may have encountered it in your day-to-day political discussions where you can no longer talk on that subject with somebody who otherwise is a good friend. Now let's look at gerrymandering. First, a definition. This is Wikipedia's. It's pretty well accepted. In the process of setting electoral districts, a practice that attempts to establish a political advantage for a particular party or group by manipulating, notice that term, manipulating, district boundaries to create partisan advantage districts. Gerrymandering may be used to achieve desired electoral results for a particular party, or may be used to help or hinder a particular demographic, such as a political, ethnic, racial, linguistic, religious, or class group. As we'll see in just a minute, gerrymandering can be used for offensive purposes, defensive purposes, or simply to perpetuate the status quo. Now, the hallmark of a gerrymander is a screwball-looking map. And you're going to see some real screwball-looking maps. And the reason is that, at bottom, gerrymandering is cherry-picking voters to achieve the politician's political ends. Does it make you feel important or valued to know that politicians regard you as pawns on a chessboard that they can move around to suit their purposes? You ought to be mad. I am. Constitutionality of gerrymanders. Well, when it's done for partisan reasons, it's always been upheld as constitutional by the Supreme Court. However, when it's been done for racial reasons, to discriminate against a particular racial group, it has been ruled unconstitutional. Now, the Voting Rights Act is a little bit of a wild card here. It can be construed as a bit at cross purposes with otherwise non-gerrymandering, but the tension between those two has never been resolved, and I don't know when it's going to be. And once again, the original gerrymander. Now, in today's gerrymandering, the original gerrymander is strictly Bush League. It's worse today than ever. Listen to this. This is from an article a year ago in the Washington Post. Both Republicans and Democrats regularly exhibit such greed and dishonesty in manipulating electoral maps that a Columbia University expert who studies the practice likened his work to that of an anthropologist who observes cannibals. Pretty graphic. And it's more prevalent today than ever. You recall, Judd Gregg says 60 to 65% of House districts are gerrymandered. Well, according to Nate Silver, the statistician, the number of swing congressional districts, naturally competitive districts, has declined from 103 20 years ago to 35 today. While the number of landslide districts has jumped from 123 to 242 in that same period. The landslide is a safe district. And here it is year by year. Number of landslide districts going up to the point where it's now almost exactly double what it was 20 years ago. And number of swing districts declining by essentially two-thirds. Now look at it state by state. Texas has 36 congressional districts, of which two are competitive. Pennsylvania, 2 of 18. Ohio, 3 of 16. North Carolina, 2 of 13. Virginia, 1 of 11. Maryland, 0 for 8. Stu Rothenberg, who is one of the best political handicappers, said that in his opinion, only 14 of 435 House districts are highly competitive. And as a result, the members of the House of Representatives have absolutely no political incentive to compromise. The Republicans all came from districts that Obama lost. The Democrats all came from districts that Obama won. Now, what does gerrymandering cause? In a one-party-controls-all situation, it often leads to overreach, passing of legislation that just gets people angry. In a divided government, it generally results in gridlock, and that's what we have right now. As I mentioned, gerrymandering can be used for offensive, defensive, or perpetuating purposes. They all have, though, one element in common. It's no longer voters choosing their elected officials. It's elected officials choosing their voters. The first type, the offensive type, is packing. That is when you concentrate as many voters of one type in a single district in order to enhance their power in that district and or reduce their influence in other districts. And here's an example of that. That thin turquoise line along the California coast there was the 23rd district of congressional district in California as it was drawn following the 2000 census. That was part of a bipartisan incumbent protection plan, and the purpose of that district was to draw a safely Democratic seat to favor Congresswoman Lois Capps. The district includes parts of three different counties. The driving distance from one end to the other is about 200 miles. The second type of gerrymandering is cracking. This is when you try to spread out voters of a particular type among multiple districts in order to dilute their strength. And here's an example of cracking. This is how the Republican-run Ohio legislature cracked Franklin County following the 2000 census. Franklin County is the home of the state capitol and also the home of Ohio State University. And both university towns and state capitals are overwhelmingly Democratic. The Republican legislature split Franklin County among three congressional districts, all of which elected Republicans, because Franklin County voters did not constitute anything close to a majority in any of them. And then there's bipartisan incumbent protection, where the boundaries are drawn to protect incumbents of both parties, some by packing and some by cracking. Now, a particularly successful example of this occurred in California following the 2000 census. The legislature drew such gerrymandered district lines that just one of the 53 congressional districts, none of the state assembly districts, and none of the 20 state senate districts changed party hands in the following decade. Let's turn to the four states that have been leaders in the effort to forbid gerrymandering. First is Montana. Nobody thinks of Montana when they think of redistricting reform. And the reason is, well, since 1992, Montana's had only one congressional district. But this applies also to the state legislature. And the four states we're going to study, I think, are all success stories. Now, they're not success stories in the sense that the legislatures there have discovered the cure to the common cold. They are successes in the sense that partisan gerrymandering is no more. Montana adopted its redistricting reform by constitutional amendment more than 40 years ago. Its districts are drawn by a commission, independent, of five citizens, none of whom may be public officials, and none of whom can become public officials for 2 years following. The Redistricting Commission, four of the members are appointed by the four party leaders in the state legislature. Now, Montana's kind of like some other states, where parts of the state hate the other parts. And there's a real animosity between eastern Montana, the plains area, and western Montana, the Rockies area. I do a lot of work in Montana. I could speak to this personally. And Montana's constitutional amendment provides that two of those four commissioners must come from the eastern part of the state and two from the western. And then they choose the fifth, who is chairman. In Montana, as in most other states, the commission has to hold public hearings so that citizens can give their input into what they think the map should and should not look like. The commission submits a draft plan to the legislature. Within 30 days, the legislature must return the plan to the commission with its recommendations, but they are only recommendations. It does not have the power to amend. It does not have the power to veto. And the commission can say, the hell with you all. And its plan, as revised, if revised, becomes law without further ado.
Who forms the commission?
Pardon? The legislative leaders appoint four members of the five, and they choose their fifth. Now, the appointments by the legislative leaders are not other legislators. One of the rules is they cannot be elected officials. Of course, the districts can't be drawn under that constitution to favor a party or an incumbent. And as a result, you can't consider where the incumbents live. You can't look at how Republican or Democratic a district is by the count of registered voters. And you can't look at previous election results. Here are the criteria that the most recent Montana Commission said it was going to follow. First, population equality to the maximum extent possible. Second, districts that are compact and contiguous. Third, districts that afford racial and language minorities at least equal opportunities to participate, and race cannot be the dominant factor. These criteria are pretty much standard. They also, and I think this is extremely important, decided that they would try to respect political boundaries, city, county, school district, Indian reservation, to the maximum extent possible, and try to respect census tracts, and try to keep communities of interest intact. Now, Iowa. Iowa is the only state that has adopted redistricting reform through the normal legislative process. And the reason is that back in the 60s and 70s, the state legislature would, following the census, take up redistricting and come up with a map, only to have it shot down by the state courts. And after a while, they just got fed up with it. And they said, we're going to quit doing this. And they turned it over to the legislative staff. And they do it today. These are the people who staff the committees of the legislature, who draft the bills, etc. They are purely non-political. They are technocrats, and they draw the lines in Iowa. The standards, very like Montana's, as nearly equal in population as practicable, coincide with the boundaries of the political subdivisions of the state. The number of divided cities and counties must be kept as small as possible. Contiguity is a factor. Again, compact. And nothing to be drawn for purpose of favoring a political party, incumbent, or member of Congress or other person or group. And as in the case of Montana, data that could be used to favor an incumbent or a party can't be considered. And so far as possible, each state representative district and each state senatorial district shall be included within a single congressional district. Here is the map of Iowa as it was drawn following the most recent census. I think that is a beautiful map. Sorry. To me, that's like a Mondrian painting. Arizona. Arizona is a recent entrant into redistricting reform. It passed a citizen initiative, Proposition 106, in 2000. It is an indication of the way legislators have made it hard to amend constitutions. And it is also an indication of the unpopularity of gerrymandering, that it required over 2,000 citizen signatures to get that measure on the ballot, and they got them. The initiative was approved by voters with 56% of the vote, and the first map was effective in the 2012 elections. As in Montana, the Redistricting Commission in Arizona has 5 members, but it's different. No more than 2 can be from the same party, which guarantees there's going to be a Libertarian or a Green or an Independent in there. And they all must be committed to applying the law in an honest, independent, and impartial fashion, and to upholding public confidence in the integrity of the redistricting process, which, to me, that is the key thing. I've been in conversation with a member of the Washington State Redistricting Commission, and I said, to whom is their loyalty? He said, their sole loyalty is to the integrity of the maps they draw. And that's what we should strive for. Their sole loyalty is to the integrity of the maps they draw. In Arizona, we've got many maps of Virginia, about 10, as a matter of fact, of particular districts which you will not recognize. As in many other states, in Arizona, to be a member of the redistricting commission, you can't have held or run for public office, or even been a party officer or a precinct committeeman, or even a lobbyist, or an officer of a campaign committee in the preceding 3 years. Now, in Arizona, they are nominated by a special organization that selects potential appellate court judges. They give you a 25-person pool, 10 of whom are Republicans, 10 Democrats, and 5 other. Then one member is chosen from each of those 3 pools by the Speaker of the House Minority Leader, the Senate Majority Leader, and the Senate Minority Leader. And that gives you 4. And those 4 choose the 5th from the same pool. But it can't be from the pool that the Republicans or Democrats came from. And the 5th is the chair. So you guaranteed in Arizona that the chair is not going to be a Republican or a Democrat. The standards in Arizona are very much like the standards in the states we've talked about thus far, except for that last standard. Arizona is the only, Arizona is the only state of which I'm aware that makes competitiveness an explicit factor, to be an explicit goal. And once again, where the candidate or the incumbent lives can't be considered, and party registration and voting history can be used only to check for compliance with the goal of competitiveness. Here's the Arizona map. It's a little bit less beautiful than Iowa, but it is a, if you know Arizona, it is a great map. 4 entire districts are located solely in Maricopa County, which includes Phoenix. 7 of the state's 15 counties are not split among congressional districts. And if you look at what the results were in terms of competitiveness, the 2012 elections resulted in 1 incumbent versus incumbent primary, and also in competitive general elections in 3 of the other 8 districts. By the way, going back to Iowa, 4 congressional districts, the 2000 elections, every single one of them was contested, 4 of 4. Finally, California. You would not expect California to have engaged in redistricting reform because for decades it was the most blatantly gerrymandered state in the union by far. It used to be said by WAGs that there was more turnover in the Soviet Politburo than there was in California elected offices. California delegated redistricting to a citizens' commission, very unique, as a result of 2 constitutional amendments, both citizen initiatives. One in 2008 that applied only to the state legislature, and one in 2010 that extended that to Congress. Over 650,000 citizen signatures were required to get each of those on the ballot, and they got them. Both major parties opposed those amendments. Now, the first one, the one that applied only to the state legislature, just squeaked through. 50.8% of the vote. But the next one, 2 years later, got over 60% of the vote. The first map was effective in the elections this past 2012. Now, I mentioned the California Commission is unique. To get on the commission, any ordinary citizen can apply. People thought this was absolutely crazy, particularly in California, you know, the land of the fruits and the nuts. It has worked out extremely well. Over 5,000 people submitted completed applications. Then a three-member panel from the state auditor's office, the Green Eyeshade people, went through all those applications and interviewed the applicants. And then they established three pools of the best applicants, 20 Democrats and 20 Republicans and 20 other or unaffiliated. The four leaders of the state legislature were each given one strike from each of the pools. So that reduced the pools to 12 each. Then the state auditor drew from the remainder in the pools by lot, three Democrats, three Republicans, and two other or unaffiliated. And those eight chose other people from the pools. And the final composition, five Republicans, five Democrats, and four other or unaffiliated. The rules that bind them, again, like Arizona, they must apply the law in a manner that's impartial and that reinforces public confidence in the integrity of the redistricting process. They can't hold elective office for 10 years, appointive office for 5, or be lobbyists, consultants, or staff for 5. The map must be approved by 9 of the 14 members and must be approved by majorities of the Republicans, majorities of the Democrats, majorities of the other. And the only way that they could be turned down is by voter disapproval in a referendum. These people took their job really seriously. They held 34 hearings around the state, at which 2,700 citizens and organizations testified, and more than 20,000 written comments were received. The standards they had to apply were clearly spelled out: population equality, geographic contiguity, geographic integrity of other political subdivisions. Again, where the office holders and candidates live couldn't be considered, and you can't draw a district for partisan purposes. And what was the result? Again, success. In 2012, this state, remember about the Politburo comparison? In 2012, it was altogether different. 4 seats changed parties. 4 incumbents retired rather than getting beat. 2 incumbents were defeated by members of their own party in primaries. 6 other seats were competitive, and there was poetic justice. The redistricting had in previous decades been done by a group called the Waxman-Berman Machine. Henry Waxman, member of Congress, Howard Berman, member of Congress, and his brother Michael Berman. Well, Howard Berman got defeated in 2012, and Henry Waxman has decided to retire because he got scared of his life. So they're gone. Okay, part 3, One Virginia 2021. Remember that I told you the hallmark of a gerrymander is a screwball-looking map? And I told you why. Because they're cherry-picking voters to suit their political purposes. You are being treated like pawns on a chessboard. Now, I'm going to show you some maps of Virginia districts. And you will see that they are in blatant violation of any concept of rationality. And they also violate Virginia's Constitution, which provides that every electoral district shall be composed of contiguous and compact territory. Now, you might say this is our logo. Now, the maps I'm going to show you alternate. I will show you a Senate map and then a House map and Senate, etc. The Senate maps were gerrymandered by the Democrats who control the state Senate. The House maps were gerrymandered by the Republicans that control the state House. Now, I defy you to tell me who the good guys are in this. This is the 15th senatorial district of Republican Frank Ruff. It stretches from Smith Mountain Lake and west of Danville to southeast of Richmond, and from Amelia to the North Carolina line. It includes parts of 11 different localities. It looks like a melting anvil to me. The objective was to pack as many Republican voters into it as possible so they couldn't affect elections elsewhere. Now, this is the 61st House District, and it overlaps significantly with Frank Ruff's Senate District. It extends from the North Carolina border almost to Palmyra. It includes all or part of 5 localities and is more than 100 miles from top to bottom. The big difference between it and Frank Ruff's district, Ruff's was drawn by Democrats. This one was drawn by Republicans. Big difference. This is the 20th senatorial district. It looks to me like a westbound ship with a sea monster's head at the rear. This is represented by Republican Bill Stanley. Now, this doesn't just cross locality lines. Virginia, as you may know, is divided pretty well into 7 distinct regions. And this crosses 3 regional lines, Southwest, South Side, Central Virginia. It has all or part of 9 localities and is more than 100 miles from one end to the other. This is the 74th House District represented by Democrat Joe Morrissey. Depending on your perspective, it either looks like to me like a chainsaw if you look at the bottom end as the where the handle would be, or you could say if you look at that from the top down, some sort of animal with a straight tail drinking. Here, the purpose of the gerrymander was to pack Democratic voters into the district so that they couldn't affect elections elsewhere. It's composed of parts of 3 localities. This, which I call the toy unicorn, is the 21st Senate District. It was designed to get as many university faculty and students into it as possible. I call it the University District. This is another example of cherry picking to achieve a desired outcome, and another example of voters being used as pawns. This is Virginia's 43rd House District. It's represented by Democrat Mark Sickles. It was designed to sweep in as many Democrats as possible so as to give Republicans a better chance of winning in contiguous districts. While it's all in Fairfax County, nobody could rightfully contend that it's compact because it extends almost from Alexandria City down past Lorton. This is the 37th Senate District, designed by Democrats to elect one of their own, David Marsden. Even though it is supposed to be for a Democrat, I call this the cruel and unusual punishment district, because unless it's August or between midnight and 4 a.m., to get from one of its portions to the other, it's going to take over an hour, because these are the most congested non-interstates in Northern Virginia that you have to traverse. I think the Democratic leadership had something against Marsden. And this is my favorite. Now, does this make The original gerrymander looked Bush. This is my favorite. This is the 72nd House District, the Richmond suburbs, represented by Republican Jimmy Massey. Now, I want to turn to some of the other reasons that I support redistricting reform. There was a very recent, April 27, Chicago Tribune editorial. Illinois is also considering redistricting reform right now. And the editorial said this much is guaranteed. If they had redistricting reform, they'd elect different Democrats, better ones, and better Republicans too. Why? Because more candidates would run if the results weren't cooked. Competitive elections bring out better candidates and motivated voters. He also said, lawmakers who don't have to worry about what happens on election day are far more accountable to their party leaders than to the voters they supposedly represent. And I agree with that. For many years, Robert Kaiser was a political reporter for the Washington Post. He recently retired, and he wrote this valedictory, which was in essence a plague on you guys. He said congressmen's electoral successes every 2 years dulled their competitive skills. They had little to offer by way of new policies or ideas. They became smug, self-satisfied. That is a almost verbatim equivalent to a comment that was quoted in Today's Progress in the article about Eric Cantor's defeat. They interviewed a Blatt voter, and he said one of the reasons that he was voting for Blatt was he wanted to see some fresh ideas. He wanted to see some good ideas. He wanted to see some problems solved as opposed to this tired old partisan crap. Why am I in this? I'm a conservative Republican. I'm on the executive board of my local Tea Party, and my business is opposition research for Republican candidates. But I'm a policy wonk, and I am a wonk in favor of good solutions to our problems, good plans to seize the opportunities that present themselves, and we're not getting those today. We used to be, when I cut my political teeth back in the William F. Buckley era, the party of ideas, when we were for many years, and we're not anymore. There isn't a party of ideas anymore among the two major parties. Gerrymandering has taken the ideas out of politics. Now, there are other problems also. I believe when you let legislators draw their own lines, that is a conflict of interest. They are torn between aiding their voters and self-preservation. The lines confuse voters. Are any of you voting in split precincts? That has got to be one of the most awful experiences. I'm an election officer. I fortunately did not work a split precinct. But those are just devilish. And they complicate life for local officials who may have to deal with unnecessary multiplicities of members of Congress, state senators, and state delegates. In Virginia, there seems to be a rule, no jurisdiction is too small to divide. The ideal size for a House of Delegates seat is approximately 80,000 people. But you look at jurisdictions that could easily fit into that. Campbell County has 3 delegates. Henry County, even smaller, 3 delegates. Prince George's County, you could fit 2 Prince Georges into a district, but they're split among 3 delegates. And tiny little Caroline County is also split among 3 delegates districts. So our plan is to end gerrymandering by ending the involvement of politicians in the redistricting process and delegate it, thank you, to an independent, nonpartisan commission bound by common sense rules. This will require, as Lee pointed out, amending Virginia's Constitution, and that's a very difficult task. As Lee mentioned, you have to pass identical legislation through two different General Assemblies separated by a House of Delegates election. And then you have to have it put on the ballot in November and pass the citizenry. Now, we know that the state speaker, the House Speaker, and the Senate Majority Leader are going to be fighting us hammer and tongs. The only way past those leaders is by drumming up overwhelming popular support. There are people who think that, well, maybe we can sweet talk these legislators into giving up the unilateral power of self-preservation that they currently enjoy. I don't happen to share that view. I think giving up power is contrary to human nature. So I think what we need is what General Schwarzkopf said, shock and awe. A massive demonstration of power. Now, it's happened before, and let me give you just one real quick example. In 1987, Congress passed the so-called catastrophic Medicare amendments. Now, catastrophic, somebody on Medicare, has one meaning. It means long-term nursing home care. But catastrophic as passed by Congress didn't include anything for long-term care. It included a prescription drug benefit, but at that point in time, in 87, a huge percentage of retirees were still covered by their former employees' health insurance. So they weren't getting anything. And what's more, for the only time in history, this law proposed to finance these improvements exclusively by having seniors pay for them. They were taxed, and the monthly premium for Part B also went up. Well, the moment people began to find out what that was about, they started raising hell. And there was one famous encounter. The guy who shepherded this through Congress, the fellow who was in all probability the most powerful member of Congress at the time, was the Ways and Means Chairman, Danny Rostenkowski of Chicago. And he went to a town meeting in his district. And he got into the meeting and he saw it was just packed with seniors. And he could tell right away they were mad. So he turned around and hightailed it out there. And the seniors followed him. He walked faster. The seniors walked faster. They have pictures of him running down the streets of Chicago. One of his aides saw what was happening, ran to the car, got the car, pulled it up to Rostenkowski. Rostenkowski jumps in the front seat. This old 80-year-old woman jumps on the hood, face down, shaking her fist through the windshield at him. Guess what happened? They repealed that law very quickly. That is what I think we're going to have to do here. Lee?
We'd like to thank you all for coming, and we urgently implore you to look at our website and become supporters. The only way we're going to be able to do this is through the grassroots effort.
Lee and Terry, thank you so much for this presentation. We've got about we've got about 25 minutes, if you have the time, for some questions and answers. And I remind you, the drill is that raise your hand, I'll call on you, and either John or Sue will give you a microphone. You have to have that. Yes, sir. Right here.
I agree that this is probably the greatest threat to democracy that we know today. But my question for you, Lee, is I heard a presentation that you made last year saying that you were going to solicit signatures at the last election, and there was no one at our polling place, at least. I'm wondering if your strategy changed, and if so, how are you going to proceed?
The logistics in doing that were overwhelming, and we did not have enough folks on board to pull that off. We're still going to try to solicit petitions at the November election of this year, but we're going to concentrate in the legislative districts where the privileges and elections members are to try to get their attention early on. Ultimately, we will attempt to assemble as many petitions as possible. One thing that you may not have picked up from Terry's presentation is that, unlike California, in Virginia you cannot have a referendum that results in legislation. We don't have that ability. We've got to go through the General Assembly.
Yes, I just have to comment on your early remarks about the hostility and the hatred between people of different opinions. Those are the extremes. Survey after survey, poll after poll has said that the vast majority of Americans want Congress to compromise, to cooperate. I don't think those extremes are helpful in trying to promote this issue. As to put the blame on the people, what was it, SORT? Where you're saying the people are at fault. Every time the redistricting thing is done, it follows an election. These people have been elected. They have the power. And it's only what Lee is trying to do from the grassroots that we can make an effect, because we don't have the power. So I would like to see the presentation point out the more positive aspects and the fact that, you know, we can do it if we get together.
You're next. Would you make a comment? California also has done two kinds of other things aimed at trying to reduce gridlock and actually get something done. It was the 2010 referendum in California where they went for the so-called top two primaries, and then also fairvote.org is advocating that at the federal level that Congress decree that they'll step back to having multi-member districts for the U.S. House. Remember in 67 they said, no, you can only have single-member districts, but Congress has in the past intervened.
The top two I'm very familiar with. It is in effect in California. We just had our second top two primary on June 3rd there. It's been in effect in Washington State since, I think, 2006, and in Louisiana for a number of years. As one commentator said on the top two primaries, it looks like every primary involving these, somebody's trying to run an experiment in game theory, because all sorts of strange things have happened. Nobody seems to know how to run a top two primary. There's no established strategy.
Describe how it works.
Say what it is.
Okay. If you go in to vote in a primary in a top two state, you don't ask for a Republican ballot or a Democratic ballot. You just get a ballot, and it has all the choices on it. And you can vote for a Republican for governor, a Democrat for U.S. senator, a peace and freedom candidate for the U.S. House, and so on. And the top two finishers, regardless of party, proceed to the general election in November. Now, in Louisiana, which has a variant of that, if the top one finisher gets 50%, there ain't no general election.
You might be interested. The Miller Center for the Study of the Presidency, connected with the university, has a series of commissions, some of which you're familiar with. The most dramatic one, of course, was the commission to cause the president to change the way he had his press conferences. And we delivered a commission report to President Reagan, and he immediately changed the way the press conferences were run. Slade Gordon, who is a former Washington senator, is a member of the Miller Center Council. And he's postulating an effort if we can get it funded, to establish a commission to examine how primary elections are held across the country, with the goal that there might be a model primary type of system.
I'd just like for you to add another map to your presentation. When Emily Couric was first elected to the Senate of Virginia, it was a very contiguous, compact Senate district. She was one of the first few women in the Senate. And so at the end of the next census, after the end of the next census, they decided that this woman should go from Charlottesville to Bath County over the mountains in the wintertime, and so possibly she and her husband might decide that that is not really a good thing for a woman to do in the wintertime. She still ran, and she still won. But Cree Deeds, who followed her, has been coming to University of Richmond at one time to a presentation, University of Virginia at one time to a presentation in January. His vehicle ran off the road into a ditch on an ice-covered road, and he was unable to get here. He wasn't injured, but his car was pretty badly damaged. So this is something right here in our own Senate district where political partisanship has tried to hurt the woman who was elected and subsequently the man who was elected. And people in our area ought to know about that. Please add that map.
If I may make an ancillary point with respect to Emily Couric, she was in the initial class of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, which is also connected with the University of Virginia now. And I'm very proud of the Sorensen Institute. It's been underway about 15 years now. We have various classes, high school, college, and then the adult class, which runs from roughly February through November, once a week for the consecutive months. And we have had 1,500 people approximately who've gone through the program since its inception. And the idea is and was to get Republicans, Democrats, and Independents selected, and to put them in a context over this 10-month period where diametrically opposed views can be clashed together in the Jeffersonian sense, but more importantly, to develop some camaraderie between the individuals, which hopefully will result in compromise if they get elected. We have 22 Sorensen graduates in the General Assembly now. We've had the former mayor of the city of Richmond, former mayor of Leesburg, and many of the others who have chosen not to go into elective politics are active in their communities. I'm very proud of the Sorensen Institute, and I think that that's an illustration of how you can go about selecting people to get into politics, which is such a tough trade, and convincing them that the Virginia noblesse oblige, the citizen's responsibility, is very important, and hopefully we're going to have a better commonwealth because of it. Thanks.
You talked about the state House of Delegates and the state Senate. Are you attempting or considering anything about the congressional districts in the state?
Our proposal would apply to all.
I think the takeaway from this is supposed to be that this job, though hard, can be done. I think it's unfortunate, though, that the presentation was cut off before we got to hear what I think is the takeaway part, so I'd like to see it continue.
How we're going to accomplish this?
This has got to be a cooperative effort. Lee and I cannot do it. As I say, we need shock and awe. We need a million old ladies on the hood of cars of Danny Rostenkowski's car, on all those legislators' cars. Another... Okay. We'll bring the pitchforks. We need you to show your support for us. We need you at the time when we call to contact your legislator. We need you to be with us visibly. We need you to take this as a voting issue. We know that people support us, but we need the intensity that makes this an important issue to them. And that's what we're trying to build up.
One last question here.
When Creed Geese was here last month, I brought this map that was in the Daily Progress showing the 3rd District, which is Richmond, and then the four little parts of the 3rd District down by Newport News. And I would think that you should put this map also in your presentation to show how out of kilter everything is. He did not mention that he had introduced bills when I asked the questions about the redistricting. So it was good to hear that he has been working on it. Thank you.
Let's thank Lee and Terry once more for leading this project.
For the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, I'm Dan Gould.